were one to be imposed in the 1990s and beyond, could fall on native land. That's the point. I mean, I didn't write this law. I'm just explaining to you what it says. Now, there are two ways of avoiding a tax on native lands. One is under amendments to ANCSA that were brought in 1980, the corporations can put their land in a land bank, and then it can be used for subsistence and it can't be taxed. But that is for a 10-year period, renewable for 5 years. The other proposal that has been made, there are many, these are only two and I mentioned them. The other proposal that has been made is for the corporations to turn their land over to traditional councils or IRA councils, as Mrs. Edwardson suggested, and then it may be that they are immune from taxation because land held by, on the basis that land held by IRAs or traditional councils is not taxable by the state. Well, those are all, I'm really trying to make something simple that is complicated, but that's what it's all about.
Well, they put us in more confusion, deeper and deeper all the time, because of the fact that we have been talking about the regional corporation turned their lands over to the RIA council, but yet we're fighting with the state of Alaska because they said that there could not be two sovereign powers within one state. And so they don't recognize our aid council, so they put a monkey wrench in that, and we can't turn our lands over to the IRA council, they're saying. And in the lands bank, as long as you put it under the lands bank shelter, you cannot develop it. But as soon as you take a portion out, they start taxing that. So that's not the answer either. So we're just right back where we started from. And so one of the things that really confused my people was the fact that in 1971, they did not inform my people that they were not going to get entitlement to individual 160 acres. And a lot of the people thought this was going to happen. So with that in mind, they did not apply for native allotment. And after the 1971 era passed and the ANCSA Act passed, the people found out 10 years later, you don't have no land. It belongs to the whole corporation. Well, how am I going to get my 160 acres? I don't know. Too late, brother. You didn't apply before 1971. You're left out in the cold. And this is the way it happened with my people. And the thing I was telling the regional and village corporation was that they should lease it to the stockholders so that in their lifetime they could at least build a cabin and say it's my own as long as I live, and then I turn back over to the corporation. That's the way it should have been. I agree with some of the people here that it's impossible, I believe, at this point in time, because you cannot take back an act and redo it all over again because it became law. But you can make amendments to the act and strongly encourage the people to try to resolve this problem areas and try to make something better out of it. My father always told me that I shouldn't look back. I should always look forward, and I think that's a very good philosophy. We cannot turn back the waters that went by town now, so we're going to have to try to make the best of what we got. This is the way I feel. And I agree with Helen Peters when she said that we should try to encourage our people to get an education so that they can deal with the problem. And in 10, 15 years, we'll have knowledgeable people that had corporate training who could take over the continuation of the village and regional corporation instead of having Caucasians working for us all the time. We've got to grab the bull by the tail and begin to educate ourselves to the fact that we should begin to do our own work instead of hiring Caucasians that have the education. And this is the avenue that we should take. We should start encouraging our young people to go to colleges and go beyond there to the business world and start doing business for our own people. I think it's about time we should start crying and say, oh, you done this to me, you done that to me, and really start rolling up our sleeves and working together, and instead of having the IRA Council and the Village Corporation fighting amongst each other. We're serving one and the same people, believe it or not. But yet, maybe it was designed that way back in Washington so that Native people would be fighting amongst each other and have no time to put their heads together and really start moving forward. I really am happy that this study is being made in the state of Alaska. I just hope and pray that something good will come out of this for the indigenous people throughout the world. I just don't want you people to make the same mistake that we made here in the state of Alaska. I cannot truthfully say at this point in time that our leaders didn't know what they were doing, because we do have one of our leaders here, Alfred Starr Sr., who worked very, very hard, even though he didn't have a high education in the sense of the word. But he did go to Washington, D.C., and he really fought hard to try to get the Settlement Act. And I laud Alfred Starr Sr. for this. And I think he should be highly commended for his past work from 61 until 1971. And he's still fighting today. I know he took money out of his own pocket to go to Anchorage to a hearing. And this is the kind of leaders that we have. A person who is really concerned, and I hope the young people can take lessons from Alfred Starr Sr. And he's one of our elders, and he's very outspoken, and I thank you, Alfred.
Before 1960s, that's about... We worked 20 years on this.
Could you say your name for the record?
Alfred Starr Sr. We worked 20 years through the University of Alaska. People there, K. Hitchcock, and I think the other lady by the name Jensen, I think. I forgot. But at that time, in that 20 years, we said that the Indians will have the land to live on. And that's the worry of the world now. I'll talk to the few natives there, some of my people. Not only you. There's other parts of the world that the white people came in, conquered their land. And that's what the Review Commission is for. And I still know that they can't live without land. Perhaps you came down a river, not the whole river is all fishing ground. That's just a few spots, few fish camps you've seen. And that was talked about in Congress, the fishing spots, where the natives gather their meat, berries and things like that to live on. At that time, that was what the Congress said before they passed the act, that they gotta have that in the future. And I hope that the Congress will look at it again. Because if they go to tax, we talk about the tax on the land that they're going to get. Unless it's developed, unless it's making money, it's the only time it should be taxed. And I remember the reservations in the States and Canada in the same way, that they didn't tax their land unless they're used for development, unless they rent it. And the people, maybe they rent their land, and the people that rent it, they make money, well, that has to go to the government. They have to pay a certain amount of tax. But the Indians themselves didn't pay. There was an article, I guess most of you people seen it. And there was a young fellow who was going to come down and talk to Tom about it. From Buffalo, Alberta. And they had a trap land like us. They live off the land trapping and hunting. And they found oil on there and they lost their trap lines. And that is that's the big talk in the country now about things like that. So that the corporations, we didn't ask for money. We didn't ask to get any money for land. We didn't. All we asked for was the land. They could have land so they could live on their land. For subsistence, hunting, fishing and trapping, like they always did, certain amount of land. And what's going to come in 1901, that's the way now. But the Indians will have to still, the natives of Alaska will still have to have their land. Some land to live on.
Is that okay?
Thank you, Mr. Starr. Thank you, sir.
My name is Charlie Campbell. Something does seem to be wrong because this is clearly dividing people against people. I hear Al talking about Caucasians. Helen is right that nothing gets done unless someone stands up for it. But beware the trap of fighting against people rather than against the injustice itself.
Anyone else who wants to speak? Billy says that he has a lot and he didn't want to take the floor unless other people were finished. Is there anyone else who wanted to add something to what they had said before?
I have something else to say again. This is Lucia. When I was talking about the economy, Lucille Summer, when I was talking about the economy, it's that somewhere along the line when our parents went off to school, we lost our language. When they came back, they didn't hardly speak it anymore. And, that was like, I don't really know how to put it. Like, when he was talking about the land and stuff, I was thinking, well, the whole point is the land in these corporations. It's not only an economy plan that they had. It's the land plan. And the reason why I talk about economy is because that's what the world looks at Alaska at in their minds is economy plan, you know. And the economy plan is important. Not it goes along with the land. I mean, when I talk about this economy plan, I'm not talking about, you know, we need money. I'm not saying we need money. It's just a fact, a whole big fact, that this is, I know, you got Taiwan, Japan, everybody looking at Alaska because of the land. And this is how United States of America is in depth and everything, and everybody is looking and watching at us. And that's why I know it has something to, the economy plan has to do something with the land, and the land is owned by the people. And it's something that I know we're gonna have something to do, to, you know, really do something about it. That's why I talk about economy. I knew everybody else is gonna talk about land, but I could see it worldwide, how people is watching Alaska, and how I know we have to get on the ball and do something about this ownership problem. We think about it, and hopefully something good will come out of it for each of us, and where we could have it back, and at least to where we're happy and we could live from day to day, like, you know, tradition, culture, and all that still too, you know, there. And that's all my concerns right there. You know.
Thank you, Ms. Summer.
I'm Helen Peters. I would like to answer that man over there in the corner by saying about people dividing. I come from a school. I spent a year in Arizona, and I have spent time with some Sioux down there. And I don't think the Indians in Alaska are like that. We're very grateful to the Caucasians. We're grateful to them for what they have done in the past and are still doing. But I think what Alfred meant is we would like to see some of our native people also in the hierarchy and doing things also. This is what Alfred meant. This is what we would like to see. But we are grateful to you people. And we're not divided like it is in Arizona or South Dakota. We never fight you, you know? We have nothing against you. Where they do, where South Dakota has something against whites, but we don't. And we're not like that. And don't take it wrong. We are grateful for what you have done in our lives, you know? And is still doing. But what Alfred meant is we would like to see our younger people also up there in the hierarchies and to do things for themselves.
I'm sorry that Charter Cameron misunderstood what I said. If I was biased toward the Caucasians, I wouldn't have Caucasians living in my house today. If I disliked white people, I wouldn't be in this society. I would be way out up in the headwaters of Ray River living like a hermit. I'm sorry that you misunderstood the word that I made. I love you just like I love my Indian brothers, and I hope you understand that. And we have to work in coordination with another. You people have the finesse, you have the education, and like Helen said, we appreciate the fact that we've had tremendous help from the Caucasian to be where we are today. The only thing I'm sorry about is that I cannot speak in my own Indian tongue. It's too bad to have to speak in a foreign tongue. And yet still say that I'm an Indian, although at heart I am. And I just wanted to correct that, Charlie. No hard feelings there. I was going to say that in as far as the economy goes, Lucia, I know that people are working quite hard in towards developing the economy in the state of Alaska as far as the Village Corporation is concerned. But the mistake we made right at the very beginning is not hiring corporate managers. We made a mistake and we suffered for it, like in Doyon, we lost $200 million because of the fact that we did not hire corporate managers like Nana did. And I think that the Village Corporations, in some instances, are saying they're very successful, but in a little small way, they're just barely keeping their head above water. And we should begin to think of 1991 because of the fact that we're going to be taxed tremendously. Tom was saying that Doyon was the largest private landowners in the world, and that's true. And we're also going to be the heaviest taxed in 1991. And this is the milestone that we have to prepare our Indian people for and begin to find ways and means of correcting this thing. So I agree with you that we should try to build up the economy so that a lot of our young people can go to work instead of committing suicide and becoming alcoholics and dope addicts. I really agree with you, Lucille, and I'm happy that one of our younger stockholders spoke up like that. And this just goes to show you that our people are really waking up to the fact of how important the Settlement Act is. So I hope we can continue to move forward like that, because I myself, I'm 60 years old now, I'm over the hill, and I'm glad that there's young people in the horizon that's beginning to really take interest and begin to carry the ball on. I know I'll be comfortable when I lay myself down in the grave and to know that there is a continuity, that this thing is not going to stop just because us old folks die off. It'd be nice to know that there's a future for our young people. And I'm glad that Lucille did speak up. Thank you.
Thank you, Al.
Is there anyone else?
There was a man talking in Fairbanks. I happened to be there one night. And he's a construction, he's a miner. Been all to the mining grounds in Alaska, also a construction man. And he was talking about this rich Devil mine down here. I think they call it Red Devil mine. And Alaska been talking about getting a route out some way to the coast, or they even talk about building a railroad through here toward that mine. But he said it's so rich. It is a miner. He might have a Native woman for wife. I don't know. That's what I thought. it's so rich that that's all of the of Alaskan natives there. Then you talk about the whole world watching this. Some parts of the world, they haven't got nothing to build homes on. And look at our timber up here in Alaska and the different things. And even some parts of the United States haven't got the land that we got and the timbers and the minerals that we got here. So I'm glad that you're talking about development, because after they got the money, I was hoping that's what will happen. Gradually, I hope that will happen. Because things like what you're talking, young people like that talking, and you're talking, that's what helps. As old people were told, we don't know where we're going to go. Maybe we wouldn't live very long, but the young people. I always talk to young people. So I'm glad to hear you.
That was Alfred Starr. I have a question for Lucille. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean when you say culture and traditions?
Look. Like, say, if I had a job, I had a office job, and it was a plan to a development plan, okay? And I know it would take, 40 hours a week to sit there and keep on top of it and make sure you're not losing no money and make sure the thing is gonna work. But then down here in my heart, I would rather be, go catch my kings while they're going by, so I'll have something else to eat in case I lose my job, how they put it was one time, when young kids go to school, after they're taught, like I was taught in survival school, how to make baskets and, sewing and doing fishnets and tanning moose skins and stuff. Then I go off to school and learn how to make speeches, and did that, and math, and sit down and do my work in school. And then after I'm done with that, I was thinking, I wish I was out in the country, after I'm all done with that, That's what I mean. It's like a culture shock, confusion, but I think it's troublesome to my generation, I think, because we're stuck in the middle, of going to do a big job to keep the land and keep the culture, then go get education, then you want to raise your family, then, it's something that, some of us could take and some of us can't take. And, that's what I think.
Yes, question at the back.
My name is Donna Searle. I've been in Alaska since the first of the year, and I came here from Wisconsin. And I've tried to listen and observe, and I have a lot of thoughts in my mind. It occurs to me that in some ways this is like a poker game where one side has the cards marked, and or a baseball game where one side has the umpire on their side. I'm not sure. I guess I tend to be cynical, but it seems that I'm not sure that the negotiation that's going on is done in really good faith on equal terms. It seems like there's a real imbalance of power, and that the imbalance is by far in the favor of the government people and the Caucasian people and the the native people are put in a position of trying to make sense out of something in which they're not sure how much of a voice they really have. I don't think that, I guess I feel skeptical, because I don't think this is a good, in good faith, that this is being done because of the imbalance of power. I would like to one time see the dominant society make some adjustments that the native people dictate. Constantly the native people are being dictated to adjust their lives, and I don't think I've seen where the dominant society has adjusted or adapted itself. I don't see them allowing themselves to listen to what native people say they would like to have happen. I realize that this is supposed to be an opportunity for people to voice their opinions and say what they would like, but I guess I think it seems like kind of a farce.
Tongue tight. No comments.
Is there anyone else?
I don't need the mic, but you got to start somewhere. It seems better to be sitting here talking than not sitting here talking.
My name is William James Walsh. I'm from Tanana. My grandfather is Alfred, or Fred Starr, and my uncle is Alfred Starr. My great-grandfather is Jacob Starr. I have a legislative history of proceedings that have been carried out since the time of the white man's coming to this place. And I'm going to lay down the law for you tonight. All of this has taken 4 years approximately to acquire what I have here. It is a history of not only the dealings of these people, but when it happened, how it happened, why it happened. Seemingly unrelated activities and incidents in the world are going to be discussed and talked about here because they relate directly to what goes on here today. First of all, I'd like to say that people talk back and forth about looking back into the past and looking on into the future. And you've got to remember that the old ancient people always knew that the here and now is here and now. That 100 years ago is like an hour, and 100 million years be like a day. And if I could speak in the tongue of these people here, I would tell you about 200,000 years of ice and darkness 25 million years ago, when the earth turned over and the circumpolar conference was born. Right after the Western man began to speaking English in the conglomerate that he has now, which is roughly 500 to 800 years old, this language, they began to travel around the world. This language is not necessarily native to any place. Therefore, it is not technically efficient to describe things where it has not been born. In order to understand this place here, you would have to have intimate knowledge of the language, because the language is a day-by-day, step-by-step instruction manual on survival in this climate. The one factor that has sustained humans here, and there have been humans against these humans trying to eradicate them, the factor that sustains them is their diet, the food. Against all of the diseases and wars, famines, the ability of the food to sustain the people in this harsh climate is why people are still here. The food comes from the land. So does all the other resources that the outside world want. A long time ago, about nearly 200 years ago, they found out about this place being here, and they realized by the plentiful food that there was something here that would make food and fur grow. And it had to be the minerals, because they began then to look into agriculture, and so they find out that the soil has something to do with the plentiful bounty of the earth. Before anyone came to claim any kind of rights around here, the Russians were here trading, kind of by accident, roaming around looking for something to do. They started what you call the Russian-American Company from the Tsarist court. Some of the most favored persons in the court got a government charter from the Tsar to become a privateer and to roam the world and to take by whatever means whatever they should like to take, whether by law or not. As time went on, it became too economically unsound of an investment to hang on to these assets in this Russian-American company. So they decided to sell to the first sucker who came along, which happened to be the United States. When they had negotiated their treaty of cession in 1867, there were some explanatory memorandum from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Department of Interior Relations, from the Emperor, the Imperial Court of Russia. Here is one. Explanatory memorandum. In answer to the communication of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Department of Interior Relations, dated August 31st, 1867, to St. Petersburg, to the American envoy near the Imperial Court. To the question concerning the system of division and measurement of landed property, which was adopted by the Imperial government in the late Russian-American possessions. The question, as stated by the government of the United States of America, has to be solved in two relations. First, in relation to the natives who occupied of your lands, which composed the Russian-American colonies. And second, in relation to the colonists who had settled in that country after it had been included into the limits of the Russian Empire. When they began to steal, they said, first of all, we have to deal with these natives before we can deal with the colonists. Adverting first to the natives of Aborigines, we may divide them into two groups, the islanders and the inhabitants of the American continent. The islanders, on their parts, must be again subdivided into two sections. the dependent and peaceful inhabitants of the Aleutian Islands and the independent inhabitants of the islands of the far north, that is, the islands Ukivok, St. Lawrence, and Nunivok. Upon these three last islands, there never existed any Russian settlement. The intercourse of Russians with those tribes is wholly confined to the limits of retail trade, for which purpose vessels of the Russian American Company were by occasionally sent thither, and therefore neither the imperial government nor the company even had any influence upon the mode of division of lands between said natives, who to the present time use such lands in perfect freedom, without any foreign interference or restrictions. That means that the Russians, the Imperial Government of Russia, did not claim to have any bearing upon those people on those islands, that they did not purport to sell them anything to the United States. Exactly in the same way, owing of character of the object which was constantly pursued by the agents of the company, neither the government nor the company had any interest to interfere in the distribution of lands between the inhabitants of the Aleutian Islands. All these islands, the boundaries of which are fixed by nature itself, are held and used by the Aleuts by right of prescription, never interrupted by any foreign violation or interference. The division of lands between the Aleutian settlements was established at a time anterior to the Russian occupation and continues to be inviolable, preserved according to the usages prevalent to all antiquity amongst the natives. That means that they had that land, they continued to hold it, the Russians had no influence and could not sell it. Neither the imperial government, by the authority conferred to the Russian American Company, nor the agents of the company, by the strength of imperial grants, ever interfered with the internal division of lands between indigenous Aleuts. And if the local administration occasionally undertook the examination of their mutual claims, it exceptionally happened in cases of misunderstanding and contest between the natives themselves, and never otherwise than upon application of the interested parties and the respective claims of parties and persons by their own authority. In other words, when two natives had a dispute, they asked for arbitration from these outsiders. To the preservation of such order in the colonies particularly contributed the peaceful and submissive character of the inhabitants of the Aleutian Islands, and therefore the amatability, or as it were, the stagnation in that respect, must not be attributed to the indifference of local administration to the interests of that country. On the contrary, the position itself on the Aleutian Islands gave birth to such immobility in the mode of turning to the account the territories of these islands. Competition alone, either between the natives or on the part of foreign settlers from abroad, might have modified the existing system of land keeping, but none of the two cases did happen, and in fact could not have taken place. They're saying that there were no white men there to contest the fact that the natives owned it and that they were not selling that. The native population of each separate island is so very insignificant that the inhabitants of any one could not meet with the slightest cause of collision of interest in the use of lands. In addition to this, the soil itself being perfectly barren and unfit either for agriculture or grazing purpose, there was no reason why the natives should endeavor to extend the limits of their lands. If they value their grounds, it is exclusively on account to strenue abounding in fish or of coast sites designated by the local name of Leda for the Aleuts, being neither agriculturists nor cattle breeders, lived exclusively upon fish and shellfishes thrown ashore by the tide, so that the welfare of the natives is measured by the abundance of sea fruit supplied by the tide, and the prosperity of Aleutian settlements is calculated by the riches of the Leda, exactly in the same way as the prosperity of continental settlements and chiefly calculated by the productiveness of the ground. In other words, they're saying that these people lived upon the land that was their sole income, that was their government way of life. Their religion would be their food and the manner in which they went after it. Out of this short outline of the condition of the islands, it is not difficult to realize the reasons why, for the time of Russian dominion over that country, we do not meet with any government regulations which would be calculated to establish among the natives any certain system of acquisition or occupation of land. There was even less ground for the enactment of any particular regulations in view of immigrant settlers. Who can ever have a mind to settle in that country where permanent fogs and dampness of atmosphere and want of solar heat and light, leaving out the question anything like agriculture, make it impossible to provide even a sufficient supply of hay for cattle, and where man, from want of bread, salt, and meat to escape scurvy, must constantly live upon fish, berries, shellfish, sea cabbages, and other products of the sea, soaking them profusely in the grease of sea beasts. They're saying that this place was so harsh that they did not see any foreigners going to live there. And so they did not claim to be selling it to the United States. To inhabit the islands, one must be Aleut. While the islands may attract transient traders, no permanent settlers. To inhabit them, one must be Aleut, and if it were not for the sea surrounding the islands, this country, owing to its unfavorable climatic conditions and its sterility,